Welcome to a special edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast, presented by the GMC Terrain. For the next little while, Sportsnet senior writer Ryan Dixon and many of the Canadiens players he grew up cheering for are going to take you on a little journey through the 1993 playoffs, the magical spring when Montreal, or any Canadian team for that matter, last won the Stanley Cup. So sit back and enjoy the story, 24 together.
I've spent a lifetime rooting for hockey's most successful team. But falling in the almost 40 age demographic, the experience of backing the Montreal Canadiens often puts me in mind of the greatest TV show ever made, The Sopranos. Tony, a gangster to the core, is sitting in a psychiatrist's office trying to figure out why he had a panic attack. He starts lamenting how his line of work has changed from his father's days, when, in his mind, people had higher standards and more pride.
It's good to be in something from the ground floor. I came too late for that, I know. But lately I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end. The best is over.
Each team a man short with just 5 seconds left. Gondo for New York, 2 seconds left, clear it in. The game is over. The Montreal Canadiens have won the Stanley Cup for the fourth consecutive time and for the 22nd time in their history. A 4-1 victory here over the Rangers.
The Canadiens won that cup 7 months before I was born. It was their 15th championship in 24 seasons. They used to talk about the usual parade route. Now, the usual, in a good year, is losing in the first or second round. In a bad year, like the one they just had, it's lottery talk.
The number 3 overall selection in the 2018 NHL draft belongs to the Montreal Canadiens.
Maybe I should have used my career as an excuse to cut ties with this team. I've been a sports writer for a dozen years now, and while the job calls for objectivity, my head has just never been able to fully KO my heart. I pay attention to every team in the NHL, but I know 10 times more about the Canadiens because I remain invested in their results. And for the entirety of my adult life, let me tell you, the results haven't been so hot. However, in the final stages of my elementary school life, late in the spring of 1993, I was an entirely unconflicted kid watching Montreal go on a tear. Nobody saw it coming, save the man who'd been hired to coach the team about 1 year prior.
Sports, Major League Baseball owners approve the sale of the Mariners to Nintendo. At 29, Tracy Austin becomes the youngest inductee of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And the Montreal Canadiens hire Jacques Demers as their next head coach. Demers will be the 18th coach in the franchise's history.
Jacques Demers was a frenetic ball of optimism who had a grand vision for his team. Early in the year, he had the boys put on their jerseys with no equipment, come out to the bench, and look up at the rafters, where he said they'd all hang Montreal's 24th banner together. It was all part of Demers' unwavering positive approach, which was felt right away by star goalie Patrick Waugh.
Jacques did a lot of things just to make you focus, think about it, and really commit. He wanted us to commit, and I think today with time, I realized that's the message that he was trying to send us.
Defenseman Patrice Brisebois was also struck by the message.
One of the first meeting, Jacques told us that we're going to shock the hockey world. And everybody looked at each other like, what does he mean? Like, you know, because Jacques says, you know what, we're going to win the Stanley Cup. The first meeting of the year. No, that was not only making the playoff, that was like, no, we're going to win the Stanley Cup. And always thinking, if you're thinking as a champion, you're going to become a champion. I think, Jacques, that was the message, like, you know what, I believe in you, the management believe in the players, and for sure, it's a long season, but there was that mentality, Jacques, have right from the bat.
Well, when I said we're going to shock the hockey world, when a coach believes in his players and you respect your players and you treat them with respect, well, eventually they're going to be able to win the big game for you. And I believe so much in team concept. I mean, you can't win if you're going to be individuals and think that an individual player could carry a whole team. I don't know if they could do it in other sports, but I tell you one thing, in hockey, you need team concept. So you have to have a little bit of luck. You have to have certainly momentum. And you have to have the athletes on your team perform at a very, very high level.
The realization of Demers' dream involved all kinds of twists and turns, from nearly losing to a hated provincial rival, to coming within a hair of facing a classic blue and white foe in the final, to actually going nose to nose against the greatest player of all time with the cup on the line. 23 titles had come either before I existed or before I was old enough to really get involved. But when it came time to pursue number 24, I lived and died with each game.
The Canadiens are many things to Montreal, an athletic, cultural, even political institution. But there's no denying what's most captivating about this hockey club is the religious fervor which surrounds it. It's almost as if each winter the Canadiens take Montreal on a quest for the Holy Grail, hockey's Holy Grail, the Stanley Cup.
The 93 Habs, often cited as one of the worst teams to win the Stanley Cup, actually had a good team that year, better than most realize. In fact, on March 1st, with about 6 weeks to go in the year, they sat atop the NHL standings. If not for a late season swoon, the Canadiens would have won their division and very well could have pushed the Pittsburgh Penguins for first overall. General manager Serge Savard had faith in the group he assembled.
102 points. Quebec had only 2 points ahead of us. They had 104, and we had more wins than Quebec. Boston won the division with 109 points. But that was a good season. You know, the team was coming up. We were a better team at the end of the season. And if you get hot and if you make a few changes, sometimes makes a whole difference. And I was pretty confident that we could beat anybody.
The 1993 playoffs were the last to be played under the old Wales and Campbell Conference format. The Campbell featured Toronto clashing with fellow original six club Detroit, while the Wales had Mario Lemieux and the Penguins facing the Devils. Buffalo, meanwhile, was trying to upset a Bruins team that finished 23 points ahead of the Sabres in the standings. Montreal opened the postseason on the road against its hated rivals, the Quebec Nordiques, and longtime Hockey Night in Canada color man Dick Irvin was there to chronicle the fierce Battle of Quebec.
You know, they talk about no cheering in the press box, and I think almost every French language reporter was cheering for the Nordiques. And it was wonderful. I mean, the atmosphere and games in Montreal and the atmosphere and games at the Colisée in Quebec, you couldn't beat it. I don't imagine at that particular time anywhere in the league. I mean, it superseded Boston in Montreal. Boston or Toronto, the big long-time rivals. When the Nordiques came to town, it was just... The two buildings were half and half. It was really amazing.
Flash, the Stanley Cup is 100 years old and there's surprise parties all across North America. One of them tonight, part of our doubleheader this Sunday on Molson Hockey Night in Canada on CBC, is at Le Colisée in Quebec City, a proud rink built in 1949, home of the Aces, the Citadels, and since 1972, the pro team, the Nordiques. And it's been dark in this proud arena for 5 years, but as you can see, the lights are up. They're excited about the playoffs and especially about the fact they open against arch rivals, the Montreal Canadiens. Good evening and welcome to Molson Hockey Night in Canada on CBC and the Stanley Cup Playoffs 1993. I'm Ron McLean. This is the best match of the playoffs on paper. The Nordiques fourth overall with 104 points. The Montreal Canadiens sixth overall with 102 points. In the last 3 years, the winners of the Stanley Cup, Edmonton in 90, were fifth. Pittsburgh in 91 and 92, sixth and seventh overall. So it's from this part of the pack the team usually comes. So as you look at this big entrance, let's soak up a little atmosphere. First playoffs in 5 years at Quebec.
But, you know, when the Nordiques won the first game, Scott Young scored the winning goal in overtime.
Dick, you get the impression, though, the Canadians have regained a little bit of confidence after a shaky start in this overtime. We've got Savard, Carbonneau, and Brunet out there now, reaching with a nice pass to Scott Young. He's had a good chance in overtime. Four goals against Montreal in the regular season. Young scores! Scott Young in overtime has won for the Nordiques!
They lost the first one. And then they lost the second one. You're not coming. Nobody was coming back to Montreal saying we're going to win the Stanley Cup. They were down 2-0 to their hated rivals. After two playoff games, they're down 2-0. It didn't look like they were going to win a Stanley Cup at that point. But then things started to happen.
One thing that didn't change, regardless of the situation, was Demers' faith in his goalie. Waugh actually struggled for large stretches of that season, posting one of the worst save percentages of his career. Demers, though, was a player's coach to the core, and as the team's lone superstar, Waugh was the last guy he was going to desert.
We had no doubt that we could come back in that one, and I remember that was probably a key moment in that playoff, because it would have been very easy for Jacques saying, okay, Patrick, you lost your first two games in Quebec. I'm going to go with André Rascot. He played really well during the season, had a really good year. And then Jacques could have turned around and said, listen, you had your chance. I'm going with the young guy. And he did the opposite. He got me in. He said, listen, I'm going to live and die with you. Then let's go out there and then win the game.
Montreal won four straight games to claim the series, two of them in extra time. It was a taxing win versus an outstanding young opponent, says winger Gary Lehman.
They had some great players. They were probably the toughest team we played against. It was probably the toughest series. So we had lost the first two games, and of course the pressure was mounting. And game three, I remember vividly, we were down a goal with a minute to go, and I set up Gilbert Dion to tie it, and then we won in overtime.
Like this.
The guys kept scoring in overtime, and Patrick kept the puck out in overtime, and it was just a snowball effect. You know, the pressure had dissipated a bit, and the confidence had it was starting to rise, and we then shocked the hockey world.
Montreal wasn't the only underdog to break through. St. Louis knocked off Chicago despite finishing with 21 fewer points. Toronto topped Detroit, the highest scoring team in the league. And Los Angeles found a way past a very strong Calgary club. And the question of who the Canadians would face in round two was answered when Buffalo staged a stunning four-game sweep of Boston, the clinching win coming in overtime of game four.
Bring it up to LaFontaine. He gets tripped up, gets it to May, and over the line. He's May going in on goal. He shoots. He scores! May Day! Brad May wins it in overtime!
Having made no less of an all-star than Ray Bourque look silly on his series winner, Brad May and his Buffalo teammates felt good about their chances facing Montreal.
We thought that we had a really good chance to beat them, and we were really confident. I mean, on this team, we have Dominic Hasek, who nobody knows at this time, but they went back to Grant Fuhr, so we have two Hall of Fame goaltenders, Howard Chuck and LaFontaine in the Hall of Fame. I mean, we had a team that should have done more damage, but that old system, you know, you always ran into Ray Bourque. You always ran into Patrick Waugh, and every game was 4-3. Patrick Waugh was outstanding. Obviously, their team deserved to win the Stanley Cup for the way they played in those big moments. But I think that was one. I know we lost all four games, but every game was 4-3, and we had a chance.
Nice pass. Daniel breaks it up. Here come the Canadians. Kirk Muller shot scores! Canadians win the series in four straight. He 11 minutes, 37 seconds into overtime. Kirk Muller's the hero. John LeClair and J.J. Daniel get the assists.
With banged up Buffalo tossed over the ropes, suddenly... the Canadians were a Final Four team that felt as though it was living the lyrics to the cheesy jam Breezeball and the Boys heard before every contest.
And I remember before every game, before going on the ice, 2 minutes or 3 minutes before every game, you know, nothing's going to stop us now. That was our song from Starship. Nothing's going to stop us now. And you know what, that's little things like that. Every time I was listening to that song, like, I was so pumped. Like, you know what? That's true. Nobody is going to stop us now.
If anything had the ability to undermine Montreal's growing sense of invincibility, though, it was the Pittsburgh Penguins. It was widely assumed Montreal would draw the two-time defending cup champions in the Wales Conference Final, but a plucky Islanders team clawed out of a 3-1 series hole to force a decisive Game 7.
Pierre Turgeon's return to the lineup for Game 7 exemplified the Islanders' intense desire to win. Despite being cast as huge underdogs, they were confident and were a game away from one of the biggest upsets in the history of hockey. Ray Ferraro summed up the team's feelings by saying, "If we lose Game 7, it's no different than if we'd gone out in 4. We're not here to just give it our best shot."
Goalie Glenn Healy was a huge reason for the Islanders' success, and he recalls how improbable that Long Island run was.
It was kind of funny because we won Game 6. Tom Fitzgerald scored a couple shorthanded goals on a power play, which has never happened before. So there was like a fate to complete. Like, we were supposed to be in Game 7. They actually didn't even have flights booked for Game 7. We flew the team out of two different airports. One out of MacArthur and one out of LaGuardia. And flew in, met, got together on the team bus, and then played Game 7. So I don't even think the ownership group believed that we would get as far as we got.
Edwards working back in. Jager deep. Takes a hit behind the goal. Extra man out for Pittsburgh. Mullen to Murphy. Murphy shot, scores! Edwards tied!
That Pittsburgh team, however number of games at the end of the year, not even ties. They won like, what, 17 straight? They walked through the first round against a team that probably went on to win the cup the next year. They had everything. Everything. We had nothing going for us. For us, that was everything for our group because we were told we couldn't win it, we shouldn't win it, we weren't better than them, and we really weren't. But with Al Arbor as your leader, you tend to believe.
More than any cup run I can recall, Montreal's 93 title had a crystallizing moment, an instance where you could suddenly think, oh my God, this could actually happen. It was May the 14th, a Friday night, and I was home by myself. At 13, my parents could have justifiable concerns about leaving me alone. It's a tweener age, and some of my fellow grade 8s were definitely getting a jump on their high school years by sneaking cigarettes on the sly. Believe me, I wish I was here telling you about how I'd been in the garage all night, in mixed company with a pack of smokes, playing the three chords I knew on a Fender, while my friends kept lookout. Had I been that kid, a much cooler adult might be telling you a story today. But I was the kid who slapped my two small Guy Carboneau jersey, one with the old crappy press-on lettering and numbers, on our black lab, Shadow, and probably frightened the poor mutt half to death when I jumped 3 feet in the air after seeing Volek bend the twine.
Samuelson's pass off a skate. Volek turns. With Ferraro, here they come. 2-on-1. Volek shoots. Scores! David Volek! Islanders! And they'll be a new Stanley Cup champion in 1993.
It is quiet again in Pittsburgh. What a hockey game. What a finish. And what a surprise. And Al Arbor, one of the greatest coaches that this game has ever known, is congratulated by the Penguins, led by Captain Mario Lemieux.
I wasn't the only one celebrating when that goal went in. About 8 hours up the 401 from my home just west of London, Ontario, the Canadians were holed up in a hotel watching the same game. When Mario and company were sent packing, everyone, including Lehman and star winger Vincent Domfus, felt the seas parting.
We were staying at the hotel. It was a decision that was made by Serge and Jacques to stay at the hotel even when we were home the night before our games at the Forum. So we're at the hotel. We're waiting to see who we're going to face. Because if Pittsburgh win, we take the flight the next day to go to Pittsburgh to start the series. And we're all in our room watching the game, and Volek scores in overtime. The game goes in overtime. As soon as he scores in overtime, you saw everybody go into the lobby, high-fiving each other and jumping up and down, because we felt like the door was open for us to do something special, to win the cup. And that's where it started to dawn on us that we have a good shot at this.
We almost celebrated as much then as when we won the cup, realizing that Pittsburgh was a big obstacle. And it was loud, and all the guys came out, and really realizing, hey, this is for real. This is it. This is your opportunity. If you're going to win a cup, this is the time.
An Islanders team operating on about a day and a half of rest was suddenly heading to Montreal to face a Habs squad that had its feet up for 8 days.
My recollection of that series was just that Patrick Roy was so good. I don't even know what his goals against was, but when I played with the Holy Redeemer Flyers, my goals against wasn't that low. And he's playing in the third round. We just couldn't score on him, and I couldn't make a mistake. And every time we went to overtime, I did. They beat us, and they were a team of destiny. So as much as we were the team of destiny in round two, they were the team of destiny in round three and four.
Honestly, I don't remember spending 1 second worrying about the Islanders. I just recall stealing a slogan I'd spotted on old highlights from an Oilers fan who made a sign that said, "The island is sinking." As soon as the matchup was set, I jumped on our family computer and made a 3 or 4 page banner with those same words. 45 minutes later, when it was finally done printing and half the ink in the house was gone, I stuck it up on the basement wall.
Nice.
Game 3 of that series was one of the few of the playoffs I didn't watch in its entirety, because it was the night of the Cheers series finale. After Sam Malone closed up shop for good, Carboneau scored an overtime marker to give the Canadians their 11th straight playoff win. They had gone a month without losing, and 4 nights later, they ousted the Islanders for a 5-game series victory.
Boy, this is something at the Forum in Montreal. Oh, the Islanders were called the little engine that could when they upset Pittsburgh, but they've run out of steam here. And we'll let the Forum fans take it home, because the Montreal Canadiens are headed to the Stanley Cup Final for the 35th time in their history.
A lot of people think that we can be overconfident. I mean, it's been 11 in a row. We have to be overconfident. Could have happened earlier than that, too. I mean, we won in 4 games against Quebec. And during the 4th game, I think we were ready to, we knew they were down and we kept them down. Against Buffalo, we did the same thing. And, you know, especially tonight against the Islanders, we're certainly going to try to do the same thing.
Let's go down and join Scott Russell.
All right, let's join Jacques Demers, the coach of the Montreal Canadiens. Jacques, the place is going nuts. Your first trip to the Stanley Cup Finals. What are you feeling now?
Well, I did it at the AFCO Cup, but this is the National Hockey League. It's great. I have great players. Thank you. The players played hard for me. I think they believe in me, but I know one thing for sure. I believe them, damn it.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Jock, but the prospect of a Montreal Canadiens-Toronto Maple Leafs final, does it excite you, scare you? What does it do to you?
Hey, let me tell you something about Pat Burns. He's done a great job down there, and I know they came back pretty strong last night, but there's a friend of mine who's coaching the Los Angeles King, Barry Melrose, so I'm not going to pick anybody. I want to give our guys a couple of days rest, and whoever comes will be ready for them, because I know they'll be ready for us.
Jacques, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jacques Demers of the Montreal Canadiens. Let's go upstairs and join Chris Cooper.
Thanks, Scott. You heard Jacques say thank you. That was Patrick Waugh delivering the game puck to the coach, a sign of what they feel for the coach that has gotten them to the Stanley Cup final.
Okay, look. I should be kicked out of hockey for rooting against a Montreal-Toronto final on the 100th anniversary of the Cup, no less. But that was just not a risk I could take. Living halfway between Detroit and Toronto, there were divided sporting loyalties in my area. But for every one Leaf hater around town, there were 10 people bathed in blue and white. The idea that the Habs could lose a Cup showdown to Toronto was just too much to bear. Leafs coach Pat Burns had left the Canadiens after the previous season to help general manager Cliff Fletcher turn things around in Hogtown. Playing in different conferences meant Toronto and Montreal faced each other just twice in 92-93, and the Buds won both contests. For that reason and more, Habs center Kirk Muller shared my apprehension about potentially facing the Leafs.
You know, I did think Toronto was probably would have given us a more difficult time because of the style they played. We didn't do well against them, I don't think, that year and all that. So they matched up well against us. L.A., the fact that they had gone so many games in the playoffs, the travel from L.A. to Toronto and back and all that, we thought they're an offensive-minded team. And, we could maybe get a jump on them with their freshness and all that. So Toronto scared me, I think, because of the style that they played.
Bonjour, mesdames et messieurs. Bienvenue à bord du Volaire Canada Star Alliance, vol numéro 6 pour Toronto.
With numerous days to rest before the final, Lehman, a Toronto native, headed home to see how the series featuring his former team would turn out. As any Leaf backer can tell you, there was a galling development along the way.
I remember actually flying back to Toronto for 3 days to watch the last two games at home with family and friends. And, of course, Gretzky has the odd good game, right?
And McCown was back to pick it up, missed it. Gretzky takes it. Gretzky from the corner, looking back to the line to Blake. Blake to Gretzky. Gretzky moving toward the net now. The shot, that's blocked. And it hurt Gilmore. He stopped the shot. It hurt him. He fell. And the play was called.
Wayne Gretzky's stick bob, I believe. And Carey Fraser's going to the linesman to ask him here. And wouldn't this be something if Wayne Gretzky was thrown out for a high stick? Gretzky slapped the puck. And then I think, and it sat, Gilmore blocked. And then I think Gretzky went for it by accident with Gilmore in the face. And there's Carey Fraser checking with the linesman. The linesman can call high stick and penalty. Let's have a look now.
My impression was that he had taken a shot. I then saw Doug Gilmore grab his chin, his glove, look, he had blood. Play ended. I went immediately, because I didn't see it, I went immediately to Doug Gilmore and I said, Doug, what happened? He said, Wayne took a shot, and his follow-through of the shot, stick hit me in the chin. I said, if that's the case, Doug, that's not a penalty. He said, okay. But something just didn't sit right, didn't smell right. You know, you develop instincts over the course of all those years and all those games. And in the pit of my gut, I just felt that something wasn't right. Typically, Wayne Gretzky would be over pleading his case. If he thought there was a potential for a penalty, he was right there. In this situation, he sort of moved off to the sidewall up by the blue line. He wasn't there. He wasn't present. Other players, Jamie McCown and other guys on the ice, were questioning me. I grabbed the two linesmen. I said, guys, I didn't see it. Can you help me? Ron Finn, who was amazingly courageous, he said, Fraser, I can't help you. He said, I was looking through their backs. I couldn't tell. The other linesman, Kevin Collins, had dropped the puck, probably had the best look at it. And he said, I'm not sure. If he did catch him, Gilmore was bent over, but I couldn't tell. All those things, you know, you're not going to make a guess on a play like that. I didn't have firm information that I could make a penalty call. I had to eat it. Now, when that happens, you just hope. You're watching the clock, and you're looking at the penalty time, and you just hope that the penalty expires and whoever wins it, it's going to be a clean goal. Well, that wasn't to happen.
Here is Sandstrom coming through center with Gretzky and over the line. Sandstrom trying to go wide and the defense was held up. Sandstrom in the corner is bumped. Gretzky in front scores!
Well, just 7 seconds left in the penalty to Glenn Anderson. And a couple of Maple Leafs players, Cecil and Ellett, both go for one player in the corner. Sandstrom makes the pass out to Wayne Gretzky, streaking in. And he puts it in. The Kings win in overtime, 5-4. We have a game seven.
Well, the Maple Leafs are going to be upset with the turn of events. The guy who high sticks Doug Gilmour scores the game-winning goal. And Wayne Gretzky gets his 10th of the playoffs from Robitaille and Sandstrom.
Robitaille!
But, people, let me just pursue two points, because a lot of people who are Leafs supporters think this is a conspiracy to get the LA Kings into the final.
Hey!
Oh, you agree with that? Well, that's ridiculous to agree with that.
I didn't agree with nothing. I just said, hey, you said it, not me.
Well, so you disagree or you agree with the fans that feel that way?
Hey, you're telling a story, kid.
Oh, I said a lot of people feel that way who are supporting the Leafs, understandably. No, of course not.
Oh.
The other question is about the other night in overtime.
Yes.
The Wayne Gretzky high stake. I'm sure the fan would like to hear your point on that.
I've been home now for 24 hours. I must have been asked 9,000 times about that incident. We don't have it. But I want to talk about it. Figure it out. Here's a guy who gets eight stitches in his chin. What happened? Who did it? Nobody knows, okay?
Unlike Don Cherry, I wasn't asking questions. All I knew was the offender, number 99, had a chance to turn Maple Leaf Gardens into his own personal playground in Game 7, which is exactly how things played out.
And good evening, everybody. Bob Cole and Harry Neal, and we're set to go, and so is Andy Van Helleman. He comes to center ice, and the Leafs are starting. Gilmour, Anderson, and Clark against Conacher, Taylor, and Reichel for the LA Kings. Game 7. This is it tonight.
Gilmour to the line with that head fake. Gets in over the line, dropping it back, but he gave it away. And here's Yari Curry trying to get away to Gretzky and over the line with McSorley. Gretzky to McSorley, back to Gretzky. Scores! Another shorthanded goal, and this has really sunk the Maple Leafs. This
is to make the play against Blake. Blake takes the puck and shoots in the center. Gretzky grabs it, and a Sandstrom. And Sandstrom back to Gretzky. Gretzky scores! Gretzky gets the pass and blasts one by Putvin. And it's the Kings leading again. 3-2.
Ellett gets it again, can't get it in front. And the Kings get it out at center ice. Gretzky kicking it ahead on the right wing. Hill chasing Gretzky. Gretzky centers! They score! Wayne Gretzky banks it in for a two-goal lead.
Here's Gilmour coming out. 10 seconds left. The crowd in a frenzy. And it's Rouse. It'll come out over the line. And the LA Kings are going to win it. 2 seconds left. And the Kings have won it. And they go on to meet the Montreal Canadiens. And a heartbreaking loss for the Maple Leafs tonight. And a big win for the LA Kings tonight. 5-4 Los Angeles. They'll meet the Montreal Canadiens in the Stanley Cup Final.
The series opened at the Forum in Montreal. The two big questions going into the game were, would the Canadiens' eight-day rest since the conference final win over the Islanders make them rusty, or would the Kings, coming off an emotional seven-game series with the Leafs just 3 days earlier, be too fatigued?
I figured you'd get a nice reception at the Forum, and you deserve it.
Yes, 16,000 against one, that should be just about even. I feel sorry for these 16,000.
Wise guy. Who will win the series, Don Cherry?
I'm picking Toronto in seven.
They're out. And Toronto fans want to know if LA wins it, how close they came. But now it's Montreal, the Canadiens, with their experience here. A quick comment, a prediction.
Well, I don't know. I tell you one thing. You don't have to be a worried kid. They're after me. They're not after you. Don't be scared.
I'm a little nervous. No,
don't be.
We're running out of time.
Okay, all I'm saying is now, Canadians play the same way. Don't take chances. They're never out of the game. Let Patrick Waugh see the puck. And for heaven's sakes, don't take dumb penalties, because this power play will kill you.
I danced when the Canadians avoided Mario Lemieux. I breathed a sigh of relief when they ducked Toronto. But maybe I didn't spend enough time worrying about drawing the most potent offensive machine in the history of hockey. The great one, slowed by a back injury that season, didn't look like himself for stretches of the year, and only got on track after a candid discussion with coach Barry Melrose.
But in February, we had a meeting, me, Gretz, Cap, and Bruce in Quebec City. And we talked about, you know, what was going on, and we had a great, it was a heart-to-heart, it was, everything was said, and, you know, Gretz basically said, I got to play more. I can't become myself again unless I play more. We had about 15 games left, and then that's when I said, okay, Gretz, you know, 15 games left, I'm going to play the shit out of you. You're going to be on the ice in, you know, 25 to 30 minutes a night, which is unheard of today. Like, nobody plays forwards that much, but... You know, if you look at Gretz's numbers, they were always high 20s, and that's what we did.
Gretzky, whose team just happened to face four Canadian teams that spring, put up 33 points in 19 playoff games through three rounds. And coming off the four-point night to eliminate Toronto, he added four more in the opener of the final. He even factored into Montreal's lone goal in a resounding 4-1 Kings triumph when... While attempting to break up a 2-on-1 pass, Gretzky reached out and tipped the puck past Kelly Rudy.
What's happening now, it's like sharks smelling blood. The players are starting to smell this taste of success and smell how close we are and feel it. And everybody's just doing whatever they can to block shots, to hit people, to clear the zone. Nobody's taking the easy way, and that's tribute to our success right now.
Gretzky toyed with us tonight. He did what he wanted. Just toyed with us, so we're not going to find any excuse. It'd be too easy to find an excuse. The Kings deserve the win.
Gretzky's heroics delivered a huge win for LA. They also prompted Carboneau, the Canadiens' captain, to make a big request of his coach.
Guy Carboneau comes to me the next morning. I had put Kurt Muller on Gretzky, and Carbo had injuries during that year, but he comes to me and says, I want Gretzky, in a respectful way. I said, let me think about it, but as soon as he asked me, I knew he was going to get Gretzky. And Carbo had played against Lemieux, against Lindros, and he says his knee's okay, he's ready to go, feel good.
The Canadiens succeeded in keeping Gretzky off the score sheet in Game 2, but their fortunes didn't improve much. Just before the halfway point of the third period, grinder Pat Conacher stuffed home a rebound from the lip of the crease to put LA up 2-1.
Conacher waits to Granato behind the net. He's out front, trying to ram it in. Waugh got enough of that. Taylor tried to tuck it in. Loose puck, score! Conacher got the backhander, and the Kings have taken a 2-1 lead.
For the best part of 2 months, everything had gone Montreal's way. Now, in a flash, the Canadiens were about 10 minutes away from falling down 0-2 in the final with two L's on home ice. The prospect of crawling back into a series that was about to shift three time zones to the west was not good, says Serge Savard.
You start to question yourself, especially when they took the lead in the first game. Now you start to question, oh my God, lose the first two games at home, going in L.A., 3-hour difference. And a lot of players says after we won in Montreal, wait till they come out west, it's going to be different. It is different when you have to travel 3 hours, time zone difference. It is different, and those guys are used to do that, and that's an advantage to them.
All-time championship-swinging gaffes can come in different forms. Think of Bill Buckner in 1986 playing first base for the Boston Red Sox. A ball gets hit his way that, 100 times out of 100, he'd pick up with no issue and make the out. Except this time it squeezes under his glove and rolls into the outfield. Usually, that's how devastation comes about. A routine play that just goes wrong.
Little roller up along first, behind the bag! It gets through Buckner!
Sometimes, though, things are derailed by a horrendous decision. We'll never know why Seattle coach Pete Carroll didn't just hand the ball to Marshawn Lynch on the goal line in Super Bowl 49. All we can say is that Malcolm Butler became a Patriots hero by intercepting a pass that should never have been thrown.
Play clock at 5. Pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler. Unreal!
That second scenario, in which an egregious choice flips the entire script, is exactly what came to define the 1993 Stanley Cup Final.
And now you see Patrick Roy, with a minute 45 left, three quarters of the way from the goal crease to the blue line.
A little early, you're right, Bob. I think Jock Demers is now telling him, half a minute. In a half a minute, keep your eye on the bench, we'll give you the signal.
And the Canadians have six skaters out here now. Here's the stick measurement. The stick measurement has been called. It's the stick of Marty McSorley.
Harry, did you ever get a measurement of Kelly Rudy's stick? I heard you last week.
But I think if you measured the length of his goal stick, you might find it illegal. And I also mentioned that Jitnik's and McSorley's stick look to be close to illegal, too. And they're now going to take a look at McSorley's. It's a two-minute penalty to L.A. if it's illegal. And it's a two-minute penalty to Montreal if it's fair. Marty McSorley, if he uses an illegal stick, is he in? And there's no excuse for that. You should have your trainer check the sticks. The game sticks, the ones that look like they might be slightly illegal.
Tip-off is the referee leaves the stick in the penalty box. And that's where it is now.
When you think of Marty McSorley, maybe a slash on Donald Brashear in 2000 comes to mind. Or the fact he was part of the deal that sent Gretzky from Edmonton to LA in 1988 because Gretz wanted him in California to provide some protection. He was a super tough guy, topping 300 penalty minutes three times in his career, including that 92-93 season when he set a personal high with 399 to lead everyone in the NHL. He also scored 15 goals that year. A feat bested by just 12 defensemen in the league. McSorley could play, and he was a valuable member of LA's top four. But what McSorley could bring to the ice was irrelevant as he watched helplessly from the penalty box while Montreal pulled Patrick Roy to go 6-on-4 in search of an equalizer.
Muller, back of the net one. Blake in there and hit his man. Desjardins ready. Schneider ready. Desjardins, no shot on the outside. Desjardins shot. Goal! They have tied it.
With two goals in regulation time, Eric Desjardins was having himself a game. And the Habs blue liner knew, given the circumstance, his was the only team that wanted any part of overtime that night.
We had confidence and at that time, we felt better than them for sure going in overtime. They didn't want to go in overtime, and they led the game like almost three periods. So when you think you're going back home 2-0 leading the series, it's a big difference in having to play an overtime game against a team that we had won 7 in a row. So I'm sure we felt better than them.
There. Rune carries in, rolling in front of the net, and a shot. Desjardins following the play, and he missed with the short side. There he is again. Scores! Desjardins! And the Canadians win in overtime, his third goal of the game. And the series is a brand new one.
Desjardins' hat trick stands as the only three-goal game by a defenseman in the Cup Final. Bob Cole's belting out Desjardins' name in three distinct syllables is the sports call of my life. I'd make it my ringtone if it wouldn't lose a little magic each time my phone buzzed. But even in the immediate aftermath of Game 2, focus quickly shifted away from Desjardins' groundbreaking performance to the decision by Demers to call for a stick check on McSorley.
One thing we always tell our players, if one of my player ever has an illegal stick, he's fined terribly. All I told our players to check, tonight. We wanted to make sure. We had a netter guy in line. He changed his stick. That's fine. And we were dead.
Yeah, like I said, I wouldn't do it. I believe the two teams should win. And, you know, like I said, I respect Jacques Demers, and he's a great man, and I'm very good friends with him. And there's nothing disparaging comments towards Jacques. It's just Barry Melrose wouldn't make that call.
I never said that I picked up a broken stick this morning on the ice. It's not true. It was visible. We looked.
Oh, if Jacques only knew how the conspiracy theories would grow. Before long, people will be talking about the layout of the old form, how it lent itself to skullduggery on the part of the Habs, and how it was Montreal, not McSorley, that was shading the rules. In the moment, though, all that mattered was that the King's D-man had been busted and Dom Fuss had a front row seat to the chaos.
You can see it. I mean, his curve was so big. We knew that Robitaille had an illegal stick, and we knew that McSorley for sure. The other ones, we weren't comfortable enough to make that call, but at the end of the day, it was really Jacques that made the call. We can tell him, but you need to have the guts to do it, because everybody's watching you when you make that call. First of all, McSorley needs to be on the ice. If he's on the bench, Robitaille is on the bench. You can't call him. He's not on the ice. McSorley was a key player for that team. He was on the ice with 2 minutes left. The situation was perfect. If that call doesn't go our way, well, we're down one goal. The odds are we would lose that game anyways. But if Jacques was right, then you get an opportunity to change things up, and that's what happened.
When the game ended, I stood there in front of the camera and I said, I take total responsibility. It's on me.
I was surprised when they turned around and they said, your stick. I was in front of the net. I was talking with Kelly. I was talking with my other defenseman. We had a face-off to handle, and, you know, like I said, I should have thought of it. I should have made sure. I'm a veteran. You know, I should have thought of it. Maybe I should have mentioned it to my teammates at the same time. I didn't.
And I remember saying to Kerry Frazier, I'm at the penalty box, I said, Kerry, this is garbage and you know it. Make sure they dot their I's and cross their T's on anything. And, you know, then I step in the penalty box.
Out of the blue, when Guy Carboneau and Kirk Muller came to me and said, Jacques wants Marty's stick measured. And I said, which part? And at that moment, I had no preconceived idea that, boy, they should be measuring Marty's stick. So with the request that was made by the captains, and they told me it was the curvature, I went to Marty. He was on the ice. He had to be on the ice for me to measure his stick. And I looked him in the eye, and I said, Marty, I need your stick, please. They've requested a measurement. And I'll never forget the look on Marty's face. The blood sort of drained from it, and it was just uh-oh. And he handed me the stick, and I looked at it, and I said, Marty, what are you thinking? This thing is so obviously illegal, I probably don't even have to measure it, but I'm forced to. And from that moment, when I went to the referee's crease and grabbed the stick gauge, I called Ray Scamp and all the linesmen over and said, Ray, I need you to hold the shaft of the stick. I wanted to make sure that that stick was measured meticulously. You have to find a fixed point on the heel with the gauge. You fix it there and you swing it, and the gauge is to slide if it has a gap anywhere. If it slides, the stick's illegal. In the middle of Marty's stick blade, the gauge didn't touch at all. There was a large gap. And typically, you don't show the captain of the team the measurement. Gretzky was standing right at the edge of the referee's crease. And because it was so illegal, and because it was such an important call at that time of the game and in the series, in the early part of the series, I said, Wayne, I'm going to show you this. And I showed him how the gauge slid without touching. All Wayne did is rolled his eyes, threw his head back, skated away. Of course, the rest is history.
Gretz was sour. Gretz is so focused, right? And he makes an absolute point, his stick and everything else, because for him, he's not leaving that gray area there.
And if there's a reason Marty's been sore about this whole situation...
Well, I think that gets back to the truth of the matter.
It's because he believes the Canadians learned his stick was illegal only after using some underhanded methods. A quick lesson in the layout of the forum. The visitors' dressing room was on the opposite side of the rink as their bench. Between periods, the opposing team's stick rack was wheeled away to keep it out of fans' reach. The room it went to was essentially the exclusive domain of the Canadians, and that's where McSorley, among other Kings players and staff, claimed Montreal could measure blades with impunity. I've reached out to McSorley before to speak about this incident. He left a blistering voicemail I wish I saved upon hearing that I wanted to talk about the illegal stick. His request at the time was that I speak to people he talked to over the years at alumni games and events, people he said would confirm his claims that the Habs weren't exactly acting in a sportsmanlike fashion. McSorley directed me to former Hab Russ Courtnell, who was traded away just before the 92-93 campaign.
Hey, Russ, it's Ryan Dixon from Sportsnet. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. I actually got your number from Marty McSorley. I'm sort of calling you on Marty's insistence, to be honest with you. Obviously, the issue of Marty's illegal stick came up, so I've talked to Marty a couple times. As I think you're well aware, you know, he's pretty insistent that there was some, you know, nefarious things going on. And he said, I want you to call Russ Courtnell because, you know, he's talked about this at banquets. He said he'd either heard you or knew you'd talked about it at a banquet in Vancouver. So I just wondered if there was anything you wanted to offer or were willing to offer about any stick measuring practices you might have known about from once upon a time.
Well, I'll tell you what, my 4 years when I played there, there's a hallway behind our locker room where our sticks and the visiting team sticks were kept between periods because there was the traffic flow from the fans down past both benches, and they passed the sticks. So obviously they had to put the sticks in a safe, secure location, which was our hallway and our dressing room. Behind our dressing room, that separated our dressing room and the medical room, and it was right where we used to work on our sticks. So in between periods, I would go back there to fix my sticks or make a stick, whatever. And if I was struggling or if I noticed a player on the other team who was a right-handed shot and I liked the curve or whatever, I would go and look at their stick because there was nobody there and you could do it. So it was available between every period of every game. The visitor sticks in the old forum were in our locker room, basically.
Well, I appreciate
it. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks for shedding some light on this, Russ.
Yeah.
All right.
No problem.
Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
What happened behind closed doors, we'll never know for sure. But what we can safely say, though, is that McSorley was caught red-handed with a banana blade at an impossibly critical juncture of the game.
I don't need to see a stick rack in the room. It never happened. I could see the stick on the ice. To me, that's all I need to know. I mean, we know sticks. Like, I mean, we've done that all our lives. You could tell if a stick is illegal or not just by watching it. You don't need to measure it beforehand. You don't need to have it in front of you. If he's got a stick on the ice at a face-off, you could tell.
Dom Fuse isn't the only one who claims innocence. Years later, before a stroke robbed him of his ability to speak in 2016, Demers had a heart-to-heart with Frazier, a fellow man of God.
And he said to me in this phone call, Kerry, listen, you're a faithful guy, and I'm a faithful guy, and we've talked at length about it. He said, I can tell you, I would never do anything to cheat, and I swear to God that I never had anyone come to me from our training staff that went over or into the dressing room to measure that stick. It would be so far against my moral compass and my principles, and I truly believe that. He did say, however, that after the first game, my players came to me and they said, Marty McSorley is playing with an illegal stick. So their eyeball, those players' eyeball on his stick, was similar to mine. It was obvious that he was using an illegal stick. Jacques said that he filed it because as much as he loves the game and he thought it was sort of a chintzy call, he told me that at that stage, down a game, down a goal, potentially going to LA, down two games, he said we were done.
25th, 1993 was the first Cup final game ever played in California. If Montreal had heaps of history, Hollywood had the star power, and the scene was outrageous.
It was great. It was awesome. Building was full every night. I come in after the game, there's Goldie Hawn, Kurt Russell, and Kate Hudson sitting in my office drinking my beer. Stallone comes in. President Reagan and Nancy came to all our playoff games. You know, where else does that happen? It only happens in Los Angeles.
Here's what else happened in L.A. The Canadians won two games that unfolded in eerily similar fashion. In both cases, the visitors built a lead, the home team clawed back to even, then the fans, celebrities or not, went home sad after John LeClair etched his name in postseason lore by scoring back-to-back overtime winners.
Here's the chance for LeClair! The Canadians won it.
Well, they have just done something no other team in Stanley Cup history has ever done, win nine consecutive overtime games.
Rebound all the way to the blue line, two-on-one break. LeClair, LeClair moving in, LeClair waiting, waiting. Hit Kelly Rooney, LeClair from the back and in. He scores! John LeClair for the second consecutive game has given the Canadians an overtime win. They're 10th.
Eventually, the 23-year-old LeClair became a 50-goal guy, and this really was his coming-out party. But the known entity in Montreal was Waugh. The fiery St. Patrick already had a Conn Smythe trophy on his resume thanks to a 1986 Cup triumph, and he was firmly established as one of the league's best goalies. His performance in 93, however, is surely his finest work. By the time they left L.A., the Canadians had won an unthinkable and, obviously, a record, 10 straight overtime games. That doesn't happen unless you've got a head-bobbing brick wall in your crease.
Donnelly with Corey Millen. Millen's in front. Shot. Save! Patrick Waugh!
Well, Patrick Waugh has been cool, calm, and very efficient tonight.
Right side to Carson. He shoots. Save! Patrick Waugh!
I think that's the most pressure Patrick Waugh has been under in playoff competition through all of these playoff games this year.
We were really expecting to win in overtime. Just ride the wave, and of course, that's when I think a lot of the attention went to Patrick, because he was incredible in overtime. Like, as good as he was in the first three periods, after that he made saves that were just out of this world. And he was backing up what he was saying in between periods after standing up saying, guys, you know, score whenever you want because they're not going to score me. And it was giving us that sense of, okay, he's got our backs, just go score. So you sort of played in a more relaxed state because of that.
Once in a while, a single frame captures the essence of an athlete. In Waugh's case, the image of him winking at King sniper Thomas Sandstrom, a sort of better luck next time moment, perfectly captures the swagger of number 33, something he discussed with Dick Irvin.
He told me that as that playoff year went on, and especially when they got to the finals against LA, which they could have easily lost, but as the finals went on and the games in L.A., he said, I got cocky. He admitted that he got cocky. And, you know, if you're a hockey coach, you'd rather have a cocky goaltender than one who's down on himself or whatever. And Patrick used that word, yeah, he said. And he didn't know the camera, television camera was on him when he winked at Sandstrom, was it? And it's been replayed how many thousand times on television in the years since, 25 years since. Help make him famous.
When you start to get in the head of the other team, I mean, the other team response most of the time is they start to push the goalie. They start to go into the net more and more. And that's the sign you know you're in their head. And for some reason, I mean, it was after the whistle. I mean, I never thought someone could cut that, quite honestly. And then it was the TV, but all of a sudden, Sandstrom was pushing, and then he went around, and then I went like, and I was like, no, you're not scoring here tonight. And it was just a reflex. You know, it was just a thing of the moment.
Sometimes they sleep, but the Lions of Winter never go hungry. Every decade, they devour at least one Stanley Cup opponent. In the 20s, they fed off a rookie with fire in his feet. Howie Morenz led the Habs to consecutive cups in 30 and 31, but then the Lions fasted for 13 years until Dick Urban came from Toronto and told Maurice Richard to get dressed. If Morenz symbolized his sport's birth, the Rocket brought baptism, and hockey became a religion here.
Wall may have been on fire, but it was Denny Savard who was reaching for a lighter before Game 5. The Canadians were a confident bunch upon returning to Quebec. They also knew, however, finishing the job was key. An injury and the strong performance of unheralded guys like Paul DiPietro conspired to keep Savard out of the lineup for most of the final. So he was free to calm his nerves in any fashion necessary, and that's exactly what he did on the afternoon of June 9th, while his roommate, Patrice Brisebois, tried to catch some shut-eye.
Yeah, I don't know why, because all the playoff had J.J. Daniel as the roommate, and the last game, I was with Denis, and Denis was, you know, really nervous, and I tried to sleep in the afternoon, and I just see a little red dot, because Denis was smoking, you know, was nervous and was smoking, so, you know, I was in the room and smoking, and like, said, Denis, don't worry, we're going to win tonight. Oh, we need to win. We need to... said, don't worry. So that was Denis. He knew I was her chance. You know what? Game 5 at the Forum. You don't want to go back for Game 6 in L.A. So I remember that day, I woke up in the morning and I said to myself, tonight, you're going to be a Stanley Cup champion.
And so, in this Stanley Cup centenary, the Canadiens' penchant for a good story and success has expectations soaring. In 1993, the best team over the course of times become the best team in overtime. And as a result, they're one result from the Stanley Cup. The Lions of Winter have been asleep for 7 seasons. Tonight, they're poised for an awakening. Still, 3 men with a mission of their own will try to tell their side to ignore the lore. They'll claim the Lions of Winter can't be kings of the jungle when the kings of California are around. Down 3-1, it's a daunting assignment, but it's just the kind these positive thinkers long for. And that, then, is the story as you arrive at the Forum in Montreal, the jungle where the Canadians are 9-1 this year, but the LA Kings with 7 road victories are tops in the playoffs in the NHL. It's LA at Montreal, Game 5.
Minutes left in the first period. Scoreless. Here's a steal. Lehman winding up. Lehman, centered in. Score! DiPietro scores on a LA giveaway. Domfus is back of the net. It's centered. Comes back to Odelein. Odelein shot. Rudy got his stick on it. And then there's Domfus back of the goal. Coming out with the rubber out. Banging away. They score. Muller scores for Montreal.
Scoring the, you know, Stanley Cup winning goal. It's the old saying. It's every kid's dream. And you know, it's something I'm very proud of and very excited to say that I was able to do it.
The LA Kings went into a defensive zone coma and couldn't recover. They had the puck out to the blue line twice. Nobody knocked anybody down in front of the net. And finally, Kirk Muller, on a turnaround, slid it through everybody to score. Here's the end of a lot of mistakes in the defensive zone coverage.
You know, I remember skating around, and maybe selfishly, the last 40 seconds, I just floated around the ice. The game was pretty much done. And I just skated around, enjoyed the moment. The fans were going crazy and kind of just took it in. The pace kind of slowed down. It was pretty much just coming to a close. And I just skated around and observed and took it all in. And the lift it was just, in Montreal, it was just such a great feeling. And, you know, then I go into the dressing room, and it's amazing. You think, oh, you're going to win it. You're going to go in. You're going to celebrate, pull the champagne. We walk in there, and it's just like you get deflated. All of a sudden, you just realize how hard it is and how exhausted you are. And I couldn't believe the boy, after that game in the dressing room, all of a sudden you just feel like the air just got taken out of you a bit, and you're just like, I am so exhausted right now. But, man, it was a great feeling.
Patrick Waugh at the side of the net. Canadians 4, Los Angeles Kings 1. Center ice. That's Muller throwing it in there along the boards. They were not supposed to be one of the favorites to make the Stanley Cup final this year, these Canadians. Ronald Corey got Serge Savard. He hired Jacques Demers. And all together, they worked a young team to the top. And now, a 24th Stanley Cup banner will hang from the rafters of the famous Forum in Montreal. The Canadians win the Stanley Cup!
I wasn't the type to worry too much about his clothes each morning, but the day after my hockey heroes had won the cup, picking out an outfit was easier than ever. As I ate breakfast in my red, white, and blue jersey, I recall my dad, yes, a Leaf fan, asking me whether I had my Habs underwear on. I assure you, if I owned a pair, they would have been on my body. I rode to school and decided to do a little rule breaking, blasting onto the yard past where bikes were supposed to be, carrying a Habs puck or pennant, something like that, while taking a victory lap. The night before, as the celebration wore on at the Forum, a security guard asked Habs center Stefan LeBeau, likely still soaked with champagne, if the Canadians would win it all again next year too. It wasn't an unreasonable question at the time. They had just done everything Demers promised they would. Why couldn't it happen again? But none of us knew the best was over and that was going to be Canada's last cup.
Looking in your eyes, I see a paradise. This world that I found is too good to be true.
That was a special edition of the 31 Thoughts podcast presented by GMC. I'm Jeff Merrick. The story was written and reported by Ryan Dixon, mixed, sound designed, and produced by Emil Delich. And the editor was Craig Battle. Special thanks to Sportsnet President Scott Moore, Dan Tavares, Sportsnet Digital's Director of Content, and John Grigg, Executive Producer of Sportsnet Podcasts. Also, huge shout-out to Kurt Barry, George Soutakis, Scott Morrison, John Wu, and Mark McDonald for their assistance in gathering many of the interviews used in this story. Stick taps as well to Carson Illich, Zach Hages, the Sportsnet Archive Departments, and to Sportsnet 590 The Fan for those amazing radio calls. Make sure to check out our big read on this amazing story at sportsnet.ca. Elliot and I will be back next week for another edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
Whatever it takes.